Washington, D.C. beginning April 1st. For fare details and to book, you can go online now at suncountry.com. Sun Country, your hometown airline.
Programming is supported by Minnesota Public Radio's educational sponsors. Together, educating and enlightening listeners and students for generations. One of the sponsors we'd like to thank is Concordia College.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio News. If Andrew Keen's first book, The Cult of the Amateur, was meant to get under people's skin, and it did, his newest is designed to provoke a more nuanced, thoughtful discussion. Keen, an internet entrepreneur, critic, and author, believes that as we shift from an industrial economy to a knowledge economy, much of it online, we're losing our sense of individuality and privacy, and he worries that as innovation moves at lightning speed, there's little debate over the ethics. That's some of what we want to talk about this morning. His forthcoming book is titled Digital Vertigo, and he joins us from KRCB in Santa Rosa, California. Andrew, good to have you back on the show.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be back.
So I thought vertigo was a very interesting and descriptive word for your book title because it implies this kind of whirling, dizzying environment that sets us off balance. Is that how you see the shift that we're undergoing?
Yeah, it's actually it's developed off the Hitchcock movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know, most of your listeners have probably seen it, the Hitchcock movie Vertigo, which was a kind of great seduction, this idea that it's a story of a man who fell in love or thought he fell in love with a blonde-haired woman, and he found out that the person he'd actually fallen in love with was a murderous brunette. And the narrative in my book is rather similar, arguing that all this social media stuff, Facebook, Twitter, everything else that we're doing in real time on the internet, on the global network, is something that we are falling in love with because we think of it as something that will develop community and bring us together. But the reality is actually the reverse. The reality is it's making us more and more separate. Now, my argument isn't a Luddite argument. I'm not suggesting it's the technology that's separating us. The nature of the technology and the more and more fragmented, isolated, lonely nature of 21st century life is as much a consequence as a cause of all this digital vertigo. But if you put all the things together, we're communicating more and more on the internet, and yet we're more and more isolated. So that's the irony, and it's a sad one, and one that most of us are beginning to realize as we become more and more addicted and dependent on these real-time networks.
Yeah, I want to probe this idea of community that you're writing about. You say seductive because we feel like we're in communication more than ever before. You can sit down at 4 o'clock in the morning and reach out to people all over the world. Now, why isn't that the reality of a deeper and more far-reaching community?
Because the nature of the technology and the communication is resulting in us not joining communities. The old version of community, the one that was developed by Tocqueville in the 19th century when he came here from France, saw America as a place of very concrete communities where people contributed to civic life, and that strengthened community and was the foundation not only of democracy but of wealthy, I don't mean in an economic sense, rich life. The problem with all the joining on the internet is it reflects not deep-rooted community, but short-term one in which people don't have the attention span or the interest to commit themselves to any given community. So we're not so much we're multitasking, we're multi-lifing. New York University sociologist describes this as a shift from what he calls the sort of the individualism of 19th and 20th century industrial life to the intra-vigilism of 21st century life. We're always in motion. We're flitting from one community, one cause, one idea, one network to the next, and we're not settled, and therefore all that's left then is that movement. We're forever in motion. It's no coincidence, perhaps, that one of the leading companies of this revolution, makers of the BlackBerry computer, are called Research in Motion.
That's right.
So We're joining. We're more and more obsessed with this idea of the social and of community and of Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and all these other networks. But the more we join, the more isolated, the lonelier we become.
I want to talk about the individual element of this, because you argue that we really need to reacquaint ourselves with the British philosopher John Stuart Mill, who wrote that defining work, that essay on liberty. Now, as I understand this, and I went back and read the essay again over the weekend, Mill argues in that essay that the laws and the force of public opinion in a society can overwhelm the rights of the individual. Is that how you interpret it?
Yeah, I think that we're living at a time now, and the digital revolution is profoundly earth-shattering as the nature of the Industrial Revolution in the middle of the 19th century. The digital revolution is changing the nature of identity and community and economy and society and all the rest of it. What Mill did in the middle of the 19th century with his book on liberty is say, look, all this Industrial Revolution is great. He wasn't against progress. He wasn't a Luddite.
Right.
But he said, in the midst of all this change, we need to protect individual rights. We need to protect the autonomy of the individual from the crowd, from the mob, who he feared. And I think that we need a new, what I call a, and I have a chapter in my book called On Digital Liberty. I think we need a similar kind of, if not book, certainly an argument, which protects, carves out the autonomy of the individual in the digital age. It doesn't mean, again, that you destroy the digital age, you don't smash the factories, you don't have to kill your computer or even switch it off. But we do need to remind ourselves of the sacredness of individualism in the digital age, and we have to understand that that and there's no evil individual, no Mark Zuckerberg or anyone else at planning this thing, but we have to protect the individual. Otherwise, his privacy, his or her privacy and secrecy, the mystery of individual life is going to be swept away. Mill understood this. He was actually arguing against Jeremy Bentham, the utilitarian. And in my book, I argue that the utilitarian 2.0 crowd are the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world, who argue that we only have one identity and see all this digital community purely in utilitarian terms and have forgotten about the mystery, the essential sort of the sacred secretness of individual life.
I think there are going to be people listening this morning, they're going to say, you know, the internet, going online, has allowed me to express my individuality in ways I never would have been able to. So if I have a form of creative expression, it allows me to get that out and have people hear that. If I want to put up a thought that I think is particularly individual, I can share that with some people and get them to react in a way that I never could before going online. What about that?
Well, there's certainly some truth to that. I mean, the idea that the internet is killing, you know, my first book was called How the Internet's Killing Our Culture. I'm going to try and be careful and not suggest that the internet is killing individualism. There is certainly some truth to the fact that the internet is enabling lots of kinds of individual self-expression. But what I'm focused on mostly in my argument in my book is what I see as, you know, I call my last book The Cult of the Amateurs. I couldn't put another cult in the title, but the cult of the social. The idea that everyone argues now, particularly online, that all things social are good, that you know, we're having and we're seeing the development in Silicon Valley of social search engines, social reading, social commerce. The big new companies in 2011, the ones that are going to do public offerings, are ones like Groupon, Facebook, LinkedIn. Everything is social. And that's because of the nature of the network and the fact that we have more and more of these connected devices and more of us are on these connected devices. In 20 years' time, there are going to be 50 billion of these devices. And already a third of the Earth's population is on this network, and probably in 10 or 15 years, it'll be over 50%. So I'm arguing a bigger argument. There are always going to be people who are enabled, empowered by the internet. If you're living in some isolated farmhouse in the middle of nowhere and you have internet access, it's great for connecting you up. But what I'm critiquing are the joiners, the online joiners, who have mistaken the social nature of the internet for real social interaction and commitment and responsibility in the world. I'm not, though, arguing that the internet isn't reality. I'm not suggesting that it's Second Life. The reality, for better or worse, of 21st century digital life is the internet has become real life. That's why the revolution's so profound. That's why I'm resurrecting, you know, Mill and looking at the Industrial Revolution as a comparative event to what's going on now.
You know, the other thing that Mill was worried about was this idea that society prefers or demands conformity. And I was thinking about how that applies to, and you probably write about this since the book is forthcoming. I've not had a chance to read the argument. But if you think about how privacy fits into that idea that social norms are pushing us to give up more and more information, that if you try to stand apart from that, it grows increasingly difficult to do that. Tell me how you're thinking about that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There is a certain conformity of the online world, if not necessarily a mob mentality. Certainly, it's a very, very easy environment to incite the crowd or the group against individuals who don't conform. It's unfortunately a very easy way of standing out. That's why you have these examples of kids who commit suicide after some event, some sexual event in particular, was revealed on the internet. So it doesn't encourage individualism. It doesn't really encourage the kind of anti-conformist thinking that Mill idealized and suggested was actually the heart of civilization. Unless you have people who stand apart from the crowd, he argued, you sink into a dull kind of conformity and society doesn't move forward. It's ironic, and this is again a complex area, that one of the cults in our modern age is of innovation, of thinking differently. Mm-hmm. So along with this ideal of thinking differently, we have an increasingly conformist digital social environment where the notion of thinking differently, the notion of innovation has become itself a kind of dogma. So what happens if you don't want to think differently? What happens if you want to stay silent? What happens if you're against innovation?
Yeah, I was going to ask you whether you think, and that is an interesting way to put it, that cult of innovation masks the conformity that's going on. Because I would think that if you talk to people, they will believe we're in one of the most individualistic, creative times in American history. Do you think that hides in some ways the demand for conformity?
Well, I think we're living at a time where and I think this reflects, again, a big shift in the industrial economy from one of firms and of a certain kind of conformity to one which Daniel Pink, the author, calls the free agent nation. The reality of the new knowledge information economy is that we are more and more isolated as workers. So we indeed have to use these networks to actually promote ourselves. So the reality of this world is that on the one hand, the network is of course social, but the real core, the real underlying truth, socioeconomic truth of this new knowledge information economy is one of more and more isolation, more and more free agent nation, where we're promoting ourselves, where we're setting up our own companies, where we don't work for individual companies for more than a year or two, of increasing mobility. Again, you can't blame the internet for this. It's as much a consequence as a cause of all this individualism. So you're right. So what happens is that you've got these two things going on simultaneously, and there are really, of course, quite incompatible. On the one hand, you have the cult of the social. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, you have this increasing individualism and its ideology, one of libertarianism and an opposition to government and all forms of control. And of course, The extreme versions of libertarianism can be seen in political movements like the Tea Party. And these things aren't really compatible, which I think accounts for the very surreal nature of the internet, one in which the people promoting or most aggressively promoting this ideal of this cult of the social are libertarians.
Andrew Keen is with us. If you've just tuned in to Mid-Morning, we're talking about some of the ideas that power his new book called Digital Vertigo. If you'd like to join the discussion, 800-242-2828. If you're in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. Online with us today, mprnews.org. And you can share some of your thoughts at facebook.com/mprnews. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Online at mprnews.org, as always. And then on Facebook today at facebook.com/mprnews. To the phones, to Alan in Watertown. Hey, Alan.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, you know, I guess I fall into the group of people that is empowered and feels like the internet is, and it, all its other forms is many or is very, very helpful to me. I understand what you're saying, that there might be a lot of people that just kind of fall into these social networks and don't. I guess I'm just trying to figure out what your point is. Like, are we supposed to do something? Is there a call to action here? Or is there? Are you just kind of making a comment?
Andrew?
Well, I'm writing a book. So it's a good question from Alan, a call to action. I mean, there are certain calls to action, I guess, in this discussion. The first is of parents. There'll be many parents listening who are worried about their kids, some of their kids, perhaps even addiction to social networks. And my response to those parents is not necessarily to ban social networks, but to understand that encouraging or allowing kids to join Facebook or join these other networks is not necessarily turning them into civic individuals. That I think it's still very important to be actually involved in one's community, and that the kind of the global networking that the internet involves and encourages doesn't really create valuable citizens. The other call to action is a reminder to people who have become too dependent on these networks is to think for themselves, are they really more connected? And is indeed their sense of anxiety and of loneliness and of isolation, might that indeed be a consequence of their dependency on the internet and on these networks? I think the book is written, as I said, in the context of what's going on now in Silicon Valley, where everything is becoming social. You have one of the reasons I think Eric Schmidt was just fired or sort of pushed out as Google CEO is he's failed to develop social search as the core of the Google search engine. You're seeing Facebook now as the dominant internet player, and it's very hard now to go on the internet, or increasingly hard to go on the internet and actually do anything in isolation. Everything is becoming social, from commerce to search to reading to everything else.
As long as we're talking about Google and Facebook, I want to ask you about something that I read that you said. You think that Google's influence is going to fade, and Facebook and some of the other social media sites that we're talking about this morning will become more influential. Is that right, and why?
Yeah, well, Google, the internet is shifting from a platform for data to a platform for people.
Mm-hmm.
And Google was the dominant player in the internet when it was purely a data platform from, say, 1999 or 2000 to today. But as everything goes social, as people begin to realize that the Google search engine is actually full of holes and often is full of spam, and they want their friends to give them relevant information and their network, so Facebook becomes increasingly well-positioned. There were two pieces in the newspaper, in the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal, in the last couple of weeks, which suggest that excuse me, that Facebook's valuation of $50 billion, which was the valuation of its last round of private investment, actually was an undervaluation. What Facebook is trying to do is replace Google as the center of the internet and turn the social into the platform. In the future, just as when we used to go around the internet, we would bump into Google buttons, in future we'll bump into Facebook buttons. And of course, they'll all lead us back to our network, and all the information, all the data derived on the internet will come through our network, and of course will be revealed to our network. So again, what we're seeing is the disappearance, the destruction of privacy, and the undermining of the individualism, perhaps, of the early years of the internet economy.
You know, this is what you've just described is what Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, calls the Facebookization of the web, where the internet is not really a place where you just encounter a lot of strangers. It's your friends, and as you point out, your network has more and more influence over what you're going to buy and where you're going to search and what you're going to watch online. So how will that change our experience of the web?
Well, it's a great point. I mean, Zuckerberg just won the Time Magazine Person of the Year for 2010. And in the description, in Time's description of why they gave Zuckerberg the award, and they weren't necessarily approving this. They were, I think, you know, Time has given the award to lots of rather dubious characters in the past, but they're important dubious characters. They say that Zuckerberg is trying to turn the internet into a large dorm room. And I think that's a really good metaphor, one in which everything we do and everything we say will be seen by our group of friends, by our network. Once again, then, it's very troubling. Those of us who want to live in a vast dorm room, I guess it's very attractive. But I think, again, going back to Mill, the idea that you can't escape that dorm room, you can't escape the opinion, the conformity of this dorm room, I think is extremely troubling. And, you know, this is not just a pipe dream of Zuckerberg. There are now, I think, 650 million people on Facebook. He's confidently predicted that there will be a billion people on Facebook by the end of 2011. Now, Facebook may be replaced by something else. The nature of the Silicon economy is one in which what Joseph Schumpeter, the Austrian economist, called, you know, endless creative destruction. There's no end point. There's always a company that will come to replace another. But if you come to Silicon Valley, if you listen to venture capitalists and journalists and futurists, the only two words you'll ever hear from them these days are social and mobile, and those two are going together. It's no longer a computer revolution. It's a revolution in which all our devices, from our car phone to our BlackBerry to our iPhone to our iPad, are all connected.
651-227-6000 to join our conversation this morning with Andrew Keene. 800-242-2828. He's talking to us this morning about this idea of digital vertigo. That's the title of a forthcoming book, and he's been talking about some of the ideas, his thinking behind that. If you're streaming us this morning at work or at home or at school, nprnews.org, and if you're on Facebook this morning, you can get in on the discussion that way, facebook.com/nprnews, to Sarah in Minneapolis. Hey, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi. What do you want to say about this?
Well, first of all, I wanted to thank you for having such a guest on your show. I'm very against social networking. I feel like it's a huge invasion of my privacy, and I don't like it. But I have friends who are passionate about it, and who I feel like they weren't very popular in high school, but now they're popular due to these social networking sites. Mm-hmm. And I am, in effect, receiving peer pressure now from them, as the popular kids, to join these social networking sites. And I will tell you that since these social networking sites have gotten more popular, my quality with the friendships of people who are so passionate about it has deteriorated immensely. I don't see them anymore. But when I do, they're like, why aren't you on Facebook? I got 11 birthday wishes today. How many did you get? I'm like, 7. So it's this really interesting process of I feel like we're getting put back in high school with immaturity and wanting to be, like your guest says, part of this peer pressure in crowd is what it feels like to me.
I can relate, Sarah. Andrew, what about that?
Sarah obviously shares my argument. I think one of the questions, though, Sarah, is do you need increasingly to use these networks for your work? Because that's the problem, is it's one thing to resist if you don't really fancy it. And there are always going to be people who will resist and just not be on it and maintain their real friendships or the friendships that most of us are comfortable with, physical friendships. But what happens when you need to be on these networks for work?
Right.
And that's one of the things that I've observed that I argue in the book is that, again, for better or worse, these networks are driving our working life. I spend some time in the book looking at LinkedIn, which is the professional network. And the narrative is involved with my association with Reid Hoffman, who's the founder and now the executive chairman of LinkedIn. And for Hoffman, he argues that it increases what he calls the liquidity of the individual in the 21st century.
What is that?
So if you want to be a liquid individual a bit. But in truth, you know, The Atlantic had a good piece this month about this new global wealthy network. The reality is if you want to be global, perhaps if you want to escape your physical community, then you need to be on these networks. So on the one hand, it perhaps benefits our professional life, but on the other hand, it certainly undermines our social and cultural life and, our core meaning as individuals. It's very hard on the radio to get into the sort of theory of what it means to be human. But if you believe that there are intrinsic truths about the human condition, and most of us, if we dig a little bit, do, beyond the sort of the orthodoxies of monotheistic religion, then I think most of us will begin to think about our autonomy and our depth and our complexity. And much of this social media revolution is challenging or undermining, I think, those notions of what it means to be a meaningful human being and have a real life, a memorable life, a life that we can be proud of as human beings.
Andrew Keen is here reflecting on what it means as we move from an industrial economy to a knowledge economy and all that that brings with it, particularly online. A break for news. When we come back, I want to talk to him about a piece that really resonated with me. I think it was Jeff Rosen wrote it in the New York Times over the summer, called "The Web Means the End of Forgetting." Some very interesting ideas brought up there, and I want to see what Andrew thinks about that. Your calls and questions as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And then a newsmaker segment towards the top of the hour in this this issue of can Jared Lee Loeffner in court today get a fair trial given all of the publicity? We'll talk about that as well. Back in a moment.
Support for this program comes from the state of Montana, with 16 ski areas and millions of acres of powder. Tools to help you plan winter vacations are online at skimt.com.
On All Things Considered, be among the first to hear what's next.
Obamacare is the crown jewel of socialism.
This is one of the largest single-day operations against the mafia.
You know you're out of money. Stop spending.
I'm Tom Cran. Join me weekdays at 3.
From Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm Matt Sepik. An explosion ripped through the International Arrivals Hall at Moscow's busiest airport today, killing at least 31 people and wounding about 130. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev called it a terrorist attack. The state news agency in Russia, citing law enforcement sources, said the explosion might have been caused by a suicide bomber. Authorities say two Florida police officers were shot and killed this morning while trying to arrest a suspect hiding in an attic. St. Petersburg Chief Chuck Hardman confirmed the deaths and says the suspect remains barricaded inside the house where the shooting happened. He says a U.S. Marshal was wounded. Former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty has a busy week ahead of him with stops in New Hampshire, Minnesota, Ohio, and Iowa. The Republican is on a month-long tour promoting his book Courage to Stand. Tomorrow's schedule includes a politics and eggs breakfast outside Manchester, New Hampshire. Pawlenty has said he'll likely make an announcement about a possible White House bid in March or April. A 17-year-old who collapsed while playing a high school basketball game in western Minnesota last week is showing signs of improvement and will be moved to the University of Minnesota Medical Center in Minneapolis for specialized care. The family of Zach Gabbard of Perham said on their webpage yesterday that the boy began responding to those around him Saturday night. However, the family says Zach remains in critical condition. The teen collapsed Thursday evening during a game at Dilworth-Glendon-Felton High School. A defibrillator was used on Gabbard before he was rushed to a hospital in Fargo for heart surgery. Strong winds are making travel difficult across much of North Dakota today. The National Weather Service issued a winter weather advisory for the entire state as gusts of more than 35 miles an hour cause snow to blow and drift. Mostly cloudy skies today across Minnesota, but warmer than it has been. Snow possible in the northern and central parts of the state. A chance of snow in the south through the day. Highs in the mid-teens in the north to upper 20s in the south. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
We're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio News. Coming up on midday at 11, the new DNR Commissioner Tom Landwehr is joining Mike Edgerly in the studio to talk about questions of wildlife parks, water, forest, mining, and more. Coming up tomorrow morning at 9, we continue our January series in which we're zeroing in on issues that will attract quite a bit of congressional debate. Tomorrow morning, we talk about transportation, and this is an interesting one because Minnesota had a lot of influence when Congressman Jim Oberstar was chairing the House Transportation Committee. He was defeated, of course, in November. New chair who does not agree with a lot of the direction that Congressman Oberstar wanted to take transportation in this country. So we're going to talk about what that means and what the nature of the debate will be in the House and the Senate here as Congress gets going on this new session. And then Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock, of course, we're talking about the context and the language of President Obama's State of the Union address. A lot of good shows coming up this week. Stay tuned for that. Andrew Keen is with us this hour, and we're talking about a book that he's in the midst of writing called Digital Vertigo and some of the ideas behind that. And Andrew, I just want to bring up this piece. I don't know if you saw it by Jeff Rosen in the Times over the summer, but let me read a couple of lines from it and get your thoughts. The piece was called The Web Means the End of Forgetting, and Rosen writes, "We're only beginning to understand the costs of an age in which so much of what we say and of what others say about us goes into our permanent and public digital files. The fact that the internet never seems to forget is threatening at an almost existential level our ability to control our identities, to preserve the option of reinventing ourselves and starting anew, to overcome our checkered pasts." What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's another of the big themes of my book. The people in Silicon Valley are very intolerant of this idea. Maybe one of the reasons why he's now the ex-Google CEO, Eric Schmidt, argued, firstly, and it's hard to know whether he was joking or not, that we should simply, if you don't want to do something, if you're uncomfortable about ever saying anything online, then don't say it. So it's this kind of utilitarian intolerance that we should always be responsible for everything we say and do, which is fine if you're an adult, but if you're a 14-year-old or a 12-year-old, an 18-year-old, and you say something inappropriate and it comes along and sort of blights your entire life, then it's another thing. Also, Schmidt argued, and this is perhaps really absurd, that because we're all so liable to do embarrassing things on the internet, and because the internet hasn't figured out yet how to forget, we should be allowed when we're 23 or in our early 20s to actually reinvent ourselves online. Mark Zuckerberg is less tolerant than Schmidt. He says very famously in the book Facebook Effect, you have one identity, and anyone who tries to escape that identity is immoral. Now, of course, the reality is we have many identities, and those identities are always shifting. And the essence, perhaps, of the American experience, Peggy Noonan wrote a very good piece in the Wall Street Journal about this last year. The essence of the American experience is to invent and reinvent themselves. I mean, the narrative in Mark Zuckerberg's life in The Social Network, for those of you, it's a great film, have seen it, is that he went west to reinvent himself, to escape one business relationship and develop another one.
That's right.
Now, what's good about this is that what's promising, and this is where perhaps technology can be the solution rather than the problem, is that there are now technologies and companies which are predicated on forgetting. So you can now used the BBC wrote a piece about this last week. There are technologies now being invented which will be timed so that you can write a post or put a video up or put some audio up which will self-destruct in a week or a month or a year or however long we choose. So I think that just as technology is creating the problem of the internet not being able to forget, it may be able to solve that problem. But this is a very big issue. And parents, of course, are very, for your listeners, parents have to be, of course, terribly aware of this. For kids who want to go to college and get good jobs, they need to understand that when they put something on the internet, for the most part, the technology is one that still hasn't learned how to forget. And kids, of course, have very short memories and assume that as they change, so the world's view of them will change. And that's not the case. So I think that the Rosen article and the notion of the web not knowing how to forget is a very, very important issue and problem in this development of a digital society.
Cody is writing on Facebook, new digital communication methods provide different avenues to express oneself. They don't fundamentally alter our understanding of a person. I'm not sure that's true. What do you think?
Well, again, I think what's happening, and there's been quite a lot of research on this, is that perhaps my generation, the analog generation that's now sort of experiencing digital for better than worse, is less sophisticated in dealing with this revolution than the so-called digital natives. Because kids who grow up in this understand that digital identity is complex. And what one must hope for with the kids who are coming online is that they don't reveal themselves and that they use this new kind of digital communication to invent online personalities rather than simply use the internet as a vast confessional to the world, a confessional which, of course, they'll come to regret. The problem, I think, again, and this comes back to the work of the New York sociologist Dalton Connolly, to ideas of Sherry Turkle and MIT professors, just written a book called Alone Together. What they're all observing is that the online community shies away from intimate communication and is lacking a center, what Turkle describes as a protean identity, an identity which is forever changing. So the problem might be, given this kind of technology, is that we're forever juvenile. We're ever changing. We're never settled. Hmm. The nature of industrial society was one in which the individual grew up and became settled, had a core identity. The problem with the internet is it seems to undermine the idea of having that settled, concrete identity. We're forever moving. We're always in motion. We're protean.
It's such an interesting idea. We could spend an hour on that, and maybe we will. To the phones, to Clyde in Aiken. Hey, Clyde, thanks for waiting.
Thank you very much for having me on, and you're welcome. My personal view of this, quite simply, is this. The internet in general, Facebook, Twitter, tweet, and all of it, is a hologram of our social structure. And for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And by the time we realize the impact of what this has done to society in a global way, it'll be like trying to breathe in a vacuum. It'll be exponentially almost impossible to recover from a lot of the things that we might regret that we have done.
What do you think, Andrew?
Well, I think that's a very interesting point. I'm not entirely sure what a hologram is. I would argue the internet's a mirror. When we look at it, we're looking at ourselves. And I think Clyde's point's an important one. I think one comparison we can make to what's going on now in the emergence of digital society is the impact of the Industrial Revolution on the environment. And we only woke up to that 50 years ago, and now we're beginning to understand the incredibly dangerous and destructive consequences of that. I think the equivalent environmental movement of the next 50 years will be one which investigates the impact of the individual on the digital revolution. So I think in that sense, Clyde's absolutely right. I think it's wrong to fixate about Facebook or Twitter or any of these other single companies. It's wrong to fixate about the iPhone or the BlackBerry or any other device. We have to understand, as Clyde is suggesting, that this is a very profound event. It's changing the nature of human identity and society in as in as profound and as significant, as deeply rooted way as the Industrial Revolution of the 1830s and 1850s and 1870s changed agricultural life.
I wonder what you think of the ethical debate or lack thereof that's going on as these changes happen so quickly. It seems like they come up, they're news for a few days, and then it kind of disappears again underneath the trampling of so much change so quickly. I mean, where should that discussion be taking place?
Well, Nicholas Carr, another of the perhaps more skeptical writers, wrote a book last year which argued that the nature of electronic discourse was actually undermining our ability to concentrate and having a very negative impact on our brains. I'm not sure if I agree with the way in which Carr sees the impact of technology on culture, but I think there's something there, and I think it's, again, ironic that our inability to concentrate, our tendency to flip from issue to issue, the real-time nature of our culture, I mean, even this kind of discussion is unusual in a Twitter-centric culture in which we flip from issue to issue and we're becoming like a flock or a horde of bees going from one thing to the next, means that it's harder and harder to concentrate. And, of course, what I'm suggesting, and I think what you're accepting is credible at least, is that we need to stop. We need to slow down. We need to think about these issues in a much more deeply thoughtful way. And the nature of technology and the impact of that technology on culture means that's increasingly difficult to do. So the problem, the form and the function of the problem are actually bound up, which again gives us this feeling of vertigo, this sense of endless dizziness, of not having any stability, of not having any solid ground to stand on.
Andrew, I'm going to close here with a call from Michelle in Woodbury. Hey, Michelle.
Hi.
What did you want to say?
I kind of hope or wish that some of the research would start looking more at the positive side of social media. I mean, I'm a parent of a teen and a tween, and I see, you know, a lot of kids who, and young adults who might otherwise be shut out from their environment, able to find communities that are very positive, especially, you know, kids who might be gay, you know, lesbian, transgender, kids who are just shy or out of the loop. I mean, I had a shy daughter who, you know, really could sort of reach out and test the water. And, you know, as long as they're given guidelines, there's just, I see so many positive things also, being able to touch the whole globe and see people as people across the globe so easily through Skype. And, you know, to me, these are all real positive things, and I'd love to see more research look at that and emphasize that in the conversation.
Andrew, a last word on that?
Well, I think that's a fair point from Michelle. A couple of points. Firstly, there's tons of research on this. There are countless books which argue that Michelle's point, that the social is enlightening and empowering the individual. My book is in my book and my thinking is in a minority. So there's no lack of that if you go to Amazon and do a search, writers like Clay Shirky. But secondly, I think, again, coming back to this issue of mill and conformity, you could argue, given the ubiquitous nature of the network, that it's harder and harder to stand out. So some of the most tragic examples of the way in which this network culture has ruined individual lives is bound up with, say, sexual unorthodoxy. So there was the case of the kid whose sex life was exposed on Facebook, and he went and threw himself off the George Washington Bridge because he was gay. So one could argue, and this is particularly the way in which I think the internet sort of brings out sometimes our most abrasive and intolerant side, that unusual actions or beliefs or those people who are not willing to sort of conform to the crowd's thinking or sexual behavior are actually more and more exposed to the ridicule of the crowd. So it works both ways, although I think Michelle is right. For kids who are troubled socially, the internet can work. I'm not suggesting that the internet is always a catastrophe. I'm not suggesting that kids shouldn't be allowed on it.
Andrew, I look forward to the book. Thanks very much for the hour today.
Thank you. That was really fun. It's always an honor to be on this show.
Andrew Keen's forthcoming book is called Digital Vertigo. His previous book, The Cult of the Amateur. Arizona shooting suspect Jared Lee Loeffner will appear in a Phoenix courtroom at 2:30 on Minnesota time. He will be arraigned on federal charges. He's expected to enter a plea. Authorities say the case could take years to make its way through the court system, but among the earliest decisions, whether Loeffner is mentally competent enough to stand trial and where that trial will be held. We've asked John Brushke to give us some perspective. He's professor of human communication studies at California State Fullerton. He's the co-author of Free Press versus Fair Trials, examining publicity's role in trial outcomes. And, Professor, it's good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
Is it possible to hold a trial, and I know they're going to do it potentially in this country, where the jurors have not heard so much information as to be influenced about the outcome of a case like this?
Well, you know, it's a big country. There are a lot of us here. Could you find 12 people who could be fair jurors? I think that's possible. And more than that, I think that what the research clearly shows is jurors will base their decision on the evidence as much as they can, and probably not on things they've heard in the media 3 or 4 years before.
Do they say that or do they do that?
The research shows that they actually do that. And I mean, one consistent finding is there's almost always a pro-defendant shift once the deliberations start. And I think, you know, a truly innocent defendant who really has all the evidence out there can get a fair trial.
Well, I want to emphasize what you just said. There is a pro-defendant shift once the deliberations in the jury room begin?
Yes.
Why?
I think that the jurors do take the question of reasonable doubt seriously, and they want to know, you know, and when they start talking about, okay, do we have reasonable doubt, they start by listing, well, what are we uncertain about? And, you know, the evidence tends, I believe, to get a little less compelling the longer you think about it. You can usually find questions, reasonable questions to ask almost all the time.
It looks like federal prosecutors are trying to bring the hearings back to Tucson. But is it to be expected that there will be a motion to move the trial, if there is one, and whenever it is, out of Tucson?
I would be surprised if they didn't move it.
In the end, move it out of Tucson?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, if you believe that there is ever a time that it's appropriate to move the venue, it's surely a case of this stature.
Again, because of all the publicity?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's the Supreme Court famously in the Shepard case said there can be a time where a defendant's fair trial is compromised by too much publicity. And if you think there's ever a case where that would happen, surely it's the one that, you know, it's on the front page of every paper for months.
So you've written a book examining publicity's role in trial outcomes. What do we know about how the publicity, pre-trial publicity, affects the outcome of the trial?
Well, most of what we know is based on experimental studies, and the purpose, our book was to look at that and then say, well, can we replicate the findings of field studies, laboratory studies and field research? And most of the lab research does show that there is a pretrial publicity bias, and our conclusion is that that generally does not replicate in actual trials.
I think that's surprising.
Well, it is the two things that you probably don't know about the criminal justice system, if you're not already a lawyer, are that 80 to 90% of people plead guilty, and of the cases that go to trial, 80 to 90% of the outcomes are guilty. So you start with only about a 4% chance of winning if you're a criminal defendant, and most of them don't have very good representation. Most of them can't conduct an independent investigation to get evidence out there. It's not really like it is on CSI, where they're dedicated people getting, you know, small microfibers of evidence. And, you know, just if you're a criminal defendant and your case is publicized, you know, you're probably going to get more attention from your public defender. You've got one resource that most people don't have.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, the case with this, we're hearing that the lawyer that's been brought in from San Diego is a very, very experienced lawyer in these cases. Of course, there will be a lot of investigatory resources, because if there is a trial, they want to make sure that it's fair. How does that get affected, though, by we now hear 24 videos of what happened, the evidence that Jared Lee Loeffner left behind? How does that affect that, do you think?
What jurors really want to do is come up with the right decision. And I do believe it's true that they don't discriminate too much if the best evidence they heard in a newspaper instead of at the trial. But in this case, it just does not seem possible that the amount of admissible evidence you know, would lead to any conclusion other than that he was the shooter. I don't even think that's going to be a question. And so, you know, can the question, I think, will come down to mental capacity. And that is such a difficult defense to win anyway.
And I wonder if public opinion influences that question of mental capacity or the outcome. I mean, have you looked at that?
Well, you know, you think it would. It just doesn't, in my opinion. One of the very first articles that I ever did was to look up all of the abuse excuse, repressed memory, Twinkie defenses, and mm-hmm. you can find them, but they win so rarely. I don't think that you could say that any one factor, and certainly not public opinion, was dictating the outcome of those cases.
What do we know about how publicity has affected some of the other very high-profile cases? I'm thinking O.J. Simpson, Elizabeth Smart's case was adjudicated in Utah. What do
we
know?
Well, I should say what we do is to look at a broad range of cases, not the individual ones. But just think about if the criminal conviction rates are 80% to 90%, think of the cases you just listed.
Mm-hmm.
And then how many of those ended up in acquittals? The Menendez brothers got a hung jury. They got a second trial. O.J. Simpson got acquitted. The LAPD officers in the Rodney King case were acquitted. If you list the high-profile cases, you find far more acquittals than you would find in the overall population of criminal cases. Which is the opposite of what you'd expect if pretrial publicity was indeed creating a huge bias against defendants. I mean, how could O.J. Simpson ever possibly have been acquitted if pretrial publicity influence
yeah.
the opinion of
no,
the jury.
That's actually a good point. We should also say that this case will take a very, very long time
yes.
to wind through the system, won't it?
That's an important factor. You're probably more tuned to news sources than just about any of us. Could you say that you remember what you read in the newspaper 3 years ago?
It depends on what it is.
Yeah, it probably does. But, you know, 3 or 4 years, human memory is just not good enough that you could remember everything that you read. Or, you know, you probably have a couple ideas that you can recollect. But the evidence that you hear at the trial that you know, will have much more depth than anything you read in the newspaper. It will have much more currency for you and much more detail.
That's right.
And I just think that the evidence presented at the trial ends up being much more important to the outcome of the case than right. the newspaper stories.
And again, that you're saying that argues for a fair trial.
Yeah, and an important thing to know is the longest delay any research has ever studied is 2 weeks.
Huh.
And as you said, this case is surely not going to come to trial for years. So even if we did know on all of our laboratory studies on undergraduates that, you know, within 2 weeks they can still remember it, I don't know that we know too much about how well jurors remember stuff 2 or 3 years later.
Professor, I really appreciate the insight. I hope you'll come back and we can talk further.
My pleasure.
Thanks
for having me.
John Brushke is a professor of human communication studies at California State Fullerton. He's the co-author of Free Press versus Fair Trials, Examining Publicity's Role in Trial Outcomes, noting this morning again that Jared Lee Loeffner, the accused Arizona shooter, in court, in federal court, at 2:30 Minnesota time. Of course, there'll be coverage through the day on the air and online here at Minnesota Public Radio. Tomorrow at 10, we talk about grade inflation. I want to hear from you, those of you in college and teaching it. This is Mid-Morning.
Right now, Congress is considering the reduction or elimination of federal support for public radio. Federal funding is used to bring you the news from Minnesota and around the world that you hear on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Mid-Morning, and Midday. Because you care deeply about Minnesota Public Radio, find out how you can help. Learn more at MinnesotaPublicRadio.org.